God, the beneficent, the merciful, the creator and sustainer of the universe, peace and blessings upon his servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Amin. I greet you with our usual greetings on the Islam in Focus program, a greeting that's been used by all of the prophets from Abraham through to Prophet Muhammad, the universal greetings of peace, assalamu alaikum, which means peace be unto you. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we start our 41st program in our series dealing with the social system of Islam. We'll be continuing our discussion of husbands' rights and beginning with some discussion of the rights of children in Islam. I have joining me on the program as usual Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Could I ask you to very quickly summarize and highlight the main points that we touched on last week in our discussion of husband's rights?
Okay, last week was a continuation of the rights of the husband, and more particularly the question of leadership within the family and quote-unquote the obligation of the wife towards him to obey him. And we talked about the evidence from that in the saying prophetic tradition. We have also examined some of the basis upon which some people interpreted this obedience on the part of the wife to mean superiority of the husband, and we have shown that in accordance with Islamic law, in letter and spirit, this is not the case at all. We have also looked into some of the main reasons why this responsibility of leadership and maintenance for the family is primarily on the shoulder of the husband. But the most important thing that we try to emphasize is that obedience in Islam, whether it relates to marital relationship or otherwise, is not an absolute submissive obedience at all, because the absolute obedience is only due to God, and any obedience to any other human being is only derived from that, and as such it is restricted and limited obedience. It must also be obedience in areas which relate more directly to the rights of the husband. It should be obedience in something which is equitable, fair, and customary. And finally, that the Quran itself even refers to the consultation, mutual consultation between husband and wife, even in matters of suckling after divorce. To conclude this, maybe I just add one more saying of the Prophet that shows that it is a matter of balance of rights and responsibilities rather than superiority or inferiority. The Prophet once was asked, as narrated in Al-Hakim, it was addressed to him, who among all people has the greatest right or claim on the woman? He said, her husband. Then he was asked, who among all the people has the greatest claim on the man? He said, his mother. See, there's a kind of equitability here in the distribution of care, rights, and responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, some of the viewers of the program may say that this sounds very fine and a great theory and so on, a concept that we could support, but what about the real life? And they would ask the question, how can we apply all of what you said in a practical way in the day-to-day life of a couple?
Well, fortunately speaking, the teaching of Islam doesn't just give some broad generalizations or motherhood statements. Many times you find also some explicit clarification, especially for the major and sensitive issues. But we have indicated in a previous discussion that a woman also is responsible, is leader, and she's responsible for her household. And in Islamic law, it was indicated that Islam exempted the woman from being the provider, or primary provider for the family. It means then that she has also some kind of similar obligation to be primarily responsible for the household. It follows from this more explicitly that it would be unreasonable to expect that the woman would leave, or the wife would leave her home without the permission or knowledge of her husband or his consent. And this is mentioned specifically in several sayings of the Prophet, especially as narrated in Al-Hakim. But even then, there are some qualifications for that too. It doesn't mean that a woman, under no circumstances, cannot leave her home without the consent of her husband. Example. As indicated before, the obligation of the individual is primarily to God before it is to a husband, wife, or anybody else. And Islam requires every Muslim, for example, to go for pilgrimage once in a lifetime. She can go if the husband refuses, even without his approval. They added also that there may be a situation where the husband is not helping his wife to learn about her faith. And since learning is an obligatory duty on every Muslim, male and female, if the husband fails to provide that, she may go out of her home and, for example, go to the mosque to listen to Islamic topics and learn about her faith. Other circumstances, like when the land of Muslims are invaded, whereby every man, woman, and anybody who is able to participate in the defense of warding off the invaders can go even without permission. Some jurists put it this way. Of course, this also does not necessarily mean that every time the woman wants to go out of her house, she goes like people go in their work. Boss, can I please go out or make a slip? And he has to sign and seal. Approved. The spirit of it is not really like that. An example of this is a woman, for example, who goes regularly to work, and her husband consent that there is no negative impact on the family affairs if she continue working. Well, she doesn't have to seek a permission every time. If she knows that it's okay, she's getting a blank approval to go out for shopping or visiting her relatives or friends, it need not necessarily be getting his consent every time. But the idea here is that there should be some reasonable discipline in the family affairs, so the husband is entitled to know where his wife is. Another manifestation also, if we really were to put it in more frank outline also, is that if the greatest claim, according to the prophetic tradition, of the greatest claim on the wife is the rights of the husband, it follows then that her obligations toward her husband supersedes her obligation to other relatives, including even her parents. This does not say that a woman is not obliged to be righteous and to be kind and considerate to her parents, but it simply means that if these rights come into conflict, then the rights of the husband prevails. And I know personally of some cases of family disputes where, for example, the parents would tell either the husband or the wife something about his spouse and even try to push them to separate them from each other, in which case, the right of the spouse should precede any advice, even from parents, which might be detrimental to the integrity and stability of their family. Or the case where the parents say, all right, come with us for a 2-month trip to the Bahamas or whatever, and the husband says, your children need you. Definitely the right of the husband would have to supersede here. Another or third manifestation is that if the work of the husband requires him to travel, she is required to go with him. If he changes residence, she has no right to say, I can't move with you. There are exceptions, however. If in the nuptial contract, in the marriage contract, a condition was put to the effect that she will not leave the country or the city or whatever, then according to many jurists, this is enforceable. She can refuse. As we have indicated in some previous programs also, if the residence or dwelling that the husband is offering to his wife does not meet the minimum basic standard in Islamic law, like lack of safety or security or basic necessities, she can also refuse to move. Or if the husband, like the chapter 65 in the Quran, changed residence in order to deliberately hurt his wife, she may not be required. But otherwise, she has to, you know, move with him wherever he goes, because after all, he is the provider of the family. A fourth manifestation is that if the wife happened to be working and the husband feels that her continuing to work full-time is detrimental to the interest of her infant or children and to the stability of her family, he has the right to ask her to quit, unless, of course, in the marriage contract, this was put as a proviso. That's as a condition that he should accept that, or else, you know, the marriage would not go through. There are, however, even some exceptions to that. You'd be surprised. According to Abu Hanifa, one great jurist, he said that in the Muslim community, there is something called fard kifaya, which means a collective responsibility, that some people should do it. If, for example, a wife happened to be trained as a midwife to help in delivery of babies, for example, and she's needed, and her expertise is required, according to Abu Hanifa, if there is such necessity, then she may not necessarily be required to obey him. She has to go when there is a pressing need to do that type of work. A fifth manifestation is that a wife should not allow or entertain any guests in her husband's house without his consent or permission. There have been references to that in Ibn Majah and At-Tirmidhi and other references. A sixth manifestation, she cannot dispose of his property without his permission, except, of course, the exception discussed in previous programs, like providing for herself and her children. And finally, a wife also should not deny her husband legitimate sexual access.
Now, that point is a rather delicate point, and I wonder if I could perhaps have you just elaborate on it a little bit further, in order that we won't have any misunderstanding about it. Perhaps you could explain the basis for it and the limitations that go with it.
Okay, perhaps we can start from the basis of marriage that was discussed previously. And one of the main inherent purposes of marriage in Islam is to provide this mutual comfort in every respect, physical, psychological, spiritual, of all sorts. And it's not only according to Islam, but according to traditions in virtually any country or any place, or any point of history. Sociologists, for example, tell us that legitimate sexual access to one's own spouse is one of the main reasons, or one of the main purposes of marriage. It follows from this that it would be rather unfair for either side to deny access, to deny that access of intimate relationship to his or her spouse. And we have seen in previous programs that Islamic law does not look into things one-sided, just in the, for the sake of male or female. You might recall that at one point it was mentioned that one of the main rights of the wife over her husband is to have this satisfaction of her instinctive needs, and we have seen again what is said about that in Islamic law and what possible ways of enforcement if that right is not respected. So again, by the same token, it would be rather unfair also for the wife to deny access to herself, mm-hmm. to her legitimately wed husband, which would lead him, of course, to be extremely uncomfortable, and that's not the purpose, really, of marriage. For that reason, we find that there are several sayings of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, as narrated in Abu Dawood, Bukhari, Muslim, and Ahmad, indicating that when the husband invites his wife for intimate relationship, she should not refuse without a just or reasonable cause. In fact, even in some acts of worship, like voluntary fasting, voluntary, that's beyond the compulsory fasting in Ramadan, the month of Ramadan, or voluntary pilgrimage, that the wife should not engage in that without the permission of her husband, because in Islamic law, a husband cannot, for example, have close relationship with his wife when she or he, either of them, is fasting. Mm-hmm. And pilgrimage also, it involves long travel and deprivation of this. I'm not talking about the compulsory. The compulsory fasting, a compulsory pilgrimage, the wife has every right to do it without her husband's permission. But this extra, which infringe on his right, must be with some kind of understanding and consent on his part. But I should make a precautionary note here, that this does not necessarily mean that the husband should be inconsiderate to the sickness of his wife, or the case where she's extremely tired or exhausted, and just make unreasonable type of demands. In fact, he would be barred, even according to Islamic law, from seeking this intimate relationship if his wife, for example, is fasting during the compulsory month of Ramadan or during the monthly period or in the postnatal period of yes. recovery. These are all forbidden. I mean, regardless whether he wants or not, she should not allow him as such. One should really add to this in conclusion that Islam, which strongly prohibited adultery and fornication, and in its regard also to the nature of the male instinct, this kind of teaching and regulations would be very important, not just for the sake of the husband, but for the sake of the integrity of the family, and to prevent any temptation to commit any evil outside the wholesome boundaries of the family.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, there's a related issue, and that has to do with the obligation of the wife with respect to housework. What does the Islamic law have to say about that?
Dishwashing and laundry?
Dishwashing and laundry and so on.
Well, the Quran provides a broad guidance to this particular issue. For example, in chapter 2, in verse 228, I think I quoted that in a previous program, وَلَهُنَّ مِثْلُ الَّذِي عَلَيْهِنَّ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ. That's for women or wives, there are rights over their husbands similar to the rights of their husbands over them in fairness and equity. But strangely enough, you'll be surprised to know that a great number of Muslim jurists, and this included such towering figures as some of the leaders of the major schools of jurisprudence in Islam, like Malik, Shafi'i, and Abu Hanifa, who conclude that a woman is not legally in Islam required to do the household because this is not an implicit or explicit part of the marriage contract. Mm-hmm. But wait a minute, I'm not calling for any rebellion on the part of wives. That's their rationale. However, we find that some other jurists differ with them. According to Ahmad, for example, he says that if we really look at it in the light of the verse just cited, that women has rights equivalent to the rights of their men or husbands over them, and if it is the customary and fair thing, as the Quran used the term, the fair and customary thing, is that the husband or the male side of the family has been equipped and prepared by God to be the main provider for the family, and that's his primary responsibility. It follows also that God has prepared the wife also to be more qualified and more equipped to look after the internal operation of the household. So there is nothing really inequitable on each of them specialize or having this role differentiation, which I think make a whole lot of sense if we look at it not in terms of selfish position, but rather the welfare of the totality of the family. The additional evidence that some jurists also say that the wife should be responsible mainly for household is that in the days of the Prophet, peace be upon him, as narrated in both Bukhari and Muslim, when his own daughter Fatima came to complain that she and her husband Ali have so much work to do and her hand was blistering from, you know, grinding the grains for food and all that, and she asked if the Prophet can appoint a servant. And the Prophet, despite of his ability to appoint, he refused. And he actually divided the work between them. And he said, Ali, you look after the work outside of the home, and Fatima, you look after the work inside the household. So if it is legally forbidden for a woman to do any housework, the Prophet would have said, all right, you don't have to do it, but you may do it. A similar thing was narrated also about Asma, the daughter of Abu Bakr, that she reported that she used to serve her husband and look after his horse even and carry things or grains over her head from his farm some distance away from their home. And again, like some jurists say, well, this was done only by way of voluntary action on their part, but they were not really required. But the other jurists say that it is not necessarily so, because the Prophet would at least indicate that you're not required to do that, but you may do it. But he agreed with this. However, I should add that the question of household is not a matter that is determined only on strict legalism. The whole purpose of marriage, as Islam has given, is the mutual cooperation, love, and reciprocity. And it depends on each case and on the circumstances. Example, I think it would be rather unfair, and I'm sure many ladies also would agree with me on this, that the husband would sweat for the whole day, especially if he has a really hard work to do, to provide for his family, and the wife stays home to watch all kind of shows on TV. He walks into the house and say, "Oh, honey, why don't you go and cook something for us, do the laundry, wash the dishes, and clean the house?" There's nothing wrong doing that work, but it sounds rather uncooperative and unfair to not to distribute the burden reasonably between husband and wife. But on the other hand, it is also rather unfair, and I'm sure that many of the male audience will also agree with me, that the husband would not disregard his wife's suffering if she's sick or tired and say, "All right, no, that's not my jurisdiction." Just like job specification in factories. Yes. It's not within my job specification. You do it. That would be rather unfair. Or to invite 25 people for dinner and then refuses to help with any dishwashing or cleaning in the aftermath. I mean, it depends on the situation itself, and it's a matter of really cooperation rather than insistence on my duty and your duty. This provides more for a setting of balanced and equitable rights and responsibilities with role differentiation, with equity, but not necessarily mathematical, superficial equality. Equity, which is more important, justice and balance in the totality of rights and responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. Well, now in the time that we have remaining in today's program, I'd like to move to some discussion of the rights of children in Islam. I wonder if I could have you perhaps give us an explanation of the basic categories of rights of children.
Well, basically, even though jurists might divide it a little differently, the way I tried to put it together, really taking different opinions, is that there could be three basic rights or broad categories of rights of children in Islam. One is the right to life. Secondly, is the right of clear lineage. And thirdly, the right of proper care and proper upbringing, mm-hmm. broadly speaking. You know.
Okay, well, perhaps we could begin to explore each one of them in turn. When you say right to life, could you explain what you mean by that?
Well, more specifically, to realize that the life of the child is something that you don't grant as parent. It all comes from God, the God who gave you life. He gave also the life to that child. And as such, nobody, no human, has the right to tamper with that life without justification. This, more specifically, implies that abortion is prohibited in Islam unless it's for, you know, very extenuating circumstances, like saving the life of the mother, and that was discussed before. It means also that one should not take the life of his children or kill them. Of course, some people might say, well, is that something to mention? It's taken for granted. But if you put it really in historical context, you realize that Islam really have added a lot to what was there before Islam. Indeed, for example, in the biblical time, according to some scholars, like Westermark, for example, in his book Origin and Development of Moral Ideals, or Ideas, he says that in the biblical time there are certain narratives, several narratives, that showed that the authority of the father, a patriarch, over his children included even the right of life and death, and that he could actually condemn, theoretically, his child to death. Of course, he concludes that this does not necessarily mean that the Hebrew father of necessity abused this particular right, but he has some authority in terms of the life. Mm-hmm. In the same reference also, a mention is made to the Western Europe, where it says that up to the year 1000, which means several hundred years after Islam even came, in Europe, the infanticide, or killing children or selling them in slavery, was still accepted and was done, especially at times of wars and famines. Among the Arabs, the pre-Islamic Arabs, before Islam, we hear also, and we discussed that previously, that they used also the female infanticide particularly, or even both. Sometimes they killed their children out of fear of poverty, which the Quran forbade, and responded that God provides for all. or more particularly girls, for whatever motives they have, whether it was bias against girls, some belief in human sacrifice, or some other reasons, whatever the reasons, Islam has totally forbid those types of practice. So at least to establish that the right of life, even from the embryological stages, is something that should not be tampered with.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the second of these rights now, the question of lineage or legitimacy?
Legitimacy means that every child should have the right, inalienable right, for secure identity, that you would have a known father. Of course, historically speaking, you know that usually the lineage is something that's related to the father. But there have been instances where a person was related to mother, especially if the mother is more famous or out of respect of her, or if the husband dies and the mother upbrings her children or grandchildren, in some cases, where the person is related to his mother. If the father or mother or both are not known, well, of course, if the father alone is not known, a person could be related to his mother by way of lineage. If both of them are not known, then according to the Quranic injunction in chapter 33, particularly in verse 4 on, that a person should be called as a brother of the faithful and a client of the faithful, but not to be given any false identity. And that's why, as indicated in some previous occasion, Islam has forbid adoption in the Western sense. It allows fostering, it allows looking after the needs of a fatherless child, but not to allow adoption in the sense of giving the name and identity of mm-hmm. the father. There should be no falsification about the real identity.
Mm-hmm. Well, now the third category of rights has to do with proper care and upbringing. Could you give some explanation of what that entails?
It entails a number of things. First of all, to receive the child with joy and happiness, and not to behave like the ignorant people in the pre-Islamic era, where if they get the news of a birth of a boy, they feel happy. If they get the news of a birth of a girl, they feel very sad and very disappointed. The Quran actually condemned this kind of feeling, that one should feel that whatever the person is getting, boy or girl, it's a gift, a blessing from God. One should not have any hesitation about that. Secondly, that a person also should express his thanks to God for this blessing by having some festive occasion. In the seventh day, or by the seventh day, the Prophet taught that the child should be given a name. If possible, his hair should be shaved, and the weight of his hair in gold or silver would be paid in charity. Also, preferably on the seventh day, 14th, 21st, or any other day afterwards, the father should sacrifice a lamb and offer it by way of festival. And the Prophet was narrated to have done that one ram, if you will, for his grandchildren, Hassan and Hussein. The other rite also includes the rite of suckling, which according to the Quran could go as far as 2 years. It includes the complete taking charge of the responsibility and duty toward the child in terms of his or her physical needs. The Quran mentioned that, and several sayings of the Prophet indicate that it is incumbent, it is a responsibility on the father. Except, of course, in the case where the child has his own or her own property by way of something that was bequeathed or inherited from some other relatives, yes, whereby you could support the child from his own property, especially if the father is not that well-to-do. But otherwise, the duty is fully on the shoulder of the father. It includes also the right of the child to get proper learning manners, learning about his faith. There are references to that in several prophetic traditions, in Tirmidhi, Ahmad, and Abu Dawood, that in one saying of the Prophet in Al-Hakim, a person should teach his child the testimony of faith, there is no God but God, or but one God. According to the Quran, one has to prevent his children from falling into disbelief. Qu anfusakum wa ahlikum nara, protect yourself and your families from the hellfire, until at least the child grows up mm-hmm. to the age of puberty, where he can decide in the matter of faith. But this information and this religious orientation should be given to the child. It is a responsibility that one cannot shun. According to a saying of the Prophet in Abu Dawood, the Prophet said also you have to teach your child the prayers when he's 7 years old and make sure that he really gets used to that. And finally, to be just and equitable in the treatment of the children, the Prophet repeatedly said that you should be just between your children, whether males or females.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we've pretty well exhausted our time for today. We'll leave it at that. We want to thank you for watching and invite you back next week when we'll begin a discussion of parental rights in Islam. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.